country, around the state, and we have a very distinguished panel, to present their ideas about the coal industry, where it's going, some proposals they have maybe in the direction that the state should be moving. In attendance today, we have Senator Vic Fisher, Senator Coghill, Senator Fahrenkamp. In the House, we have Representative Pierce, Representative Thompson, Representative Miller, and myself, Dick Schultz. At this time, I would like to ask, we do have some people on teleconference and from around the state, and I would like to ask each one of the teleconference sites just to come on and identify yourself and give us your name, et cetera. I'll call on Anchorage first. You can begin.
This is Jan Anchorage. Did you want the people here that are participating?
Yes, I do.
Okay, we have four gentlemen here who were requested to be here by groups that they're representing. Dick Gentlemen from the Alaska Power Authority, Sam Dunaway from the DNR, Peter Dennis from DNR, Obie Weeks from the Alaska Railroad.
Okay. Thank you. We have other sites on. Fairbanks.
This is Virgil Gillespie in Fairbanks, representing FMUS. I'm here to answer questions, but not testify. We also have a representative from Golden Valley, Taylor Cordell.
Okay, thank you. Do we have anyone from Mattsuit this time on? What about Seward? Okay, very good. With that, Nenana? Is there anyone from Nenana?
Come on, Steve.
Okay. The calls are still coming in, so we'll give them time to get online. As I stated before, the purpose of this meeting is to get a briefing and the opportunity of the members to become cognizant of what is going on at the coal industry today and how it may lend itself to the energy problems that the state of Alaska is facing. With that in mind, I'd like to turn the meeting over to John Sims and would ask John to go ahead. And John is the president of the Coal Association, and I'll ask him to go ahead and introduce the other members.
Mr. Chairman, senators, representatives, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to present the coal option to this hearing today. At the outset, let me introduce the people who will be participating. We have Chuck Hawley, C.C. Hawley & Associates, Jim Shaw of Rocky Mountain Energy, Cole McFarlane of Placer U.S., Joe Uzzavelli, Uzzavelli Coal Mine, and Robert Stiles of Diamond Shamrock. It's very easy to forget the competition.
Thank you, Andrew. Don, do you have the switch up?
Yes.
Okay. And as each one of you comment, I would appreciate it if you would flip the switch up for the people in the listening audience. But we also have, at this time, we have Seward on also.
By way of introduction, I think the coal operators and Alaska leaseholders, of which I am the president, being the new boy on the block, about a year ago, started to prepare an informational package on coal and the very real option that coal players could play in the future energy requirements of the Alaskan Rail Belt. Each of you were given a copy of that report, a briefing book as a resource, on which to refer to when issues relating to our industry come before you. We feel that contains a wealth of information that's presented in an unbiased and factual way and helps address some of the very serious deficiencies which we've seen emerge in the discussion of coal, particularly by the Alaska Power Authority. That informational package, as I say, contains a wealth of information which we hope that you will use as matters relating to the coal industry come before you. Let me say a little bit about the coal resource in Alaska, because it truly is one of our great strengths. By various estimates, the resource has been placed at representing perhaps 40% or more of the total US coal resources. And yet, the industry at its present time is producing less than 0.1% of the total US production. So with that enormous resource base and the relatively minuscule size of the production base at this time, we feel that the coal industry has a lot of way, in Alaska, has a long way to grow. The location of the resource in the rail belt, of course, is another of the great strengths which we feel the coal industry has. It's accessible. It's an industry which provides and will provide a growing number of year-round jobs. It's an industry which we feel can supply at very basic costs the fuel to energize a considerable part of the Alaskan Rail Belt energy needs in the future. It should be apparent to everybody sitting around the table here that we do represent in our group, the coal operators and Alaska leaseholders, competitive interests. So we do represent an industry which is going to be highly competitive in the field of mining coal and supplying that coal not only for export markets but for base load power generation in the rail belt. There's one thing also which I think is worth noting and perhaps hasn't been brought out, and it might be emphasized again this afternoon, and that is that the competing nations, which are very major exporters of coal, do have very strong domestic utilization of their resource. I think it's a fallacy if we in Alaska sit back and think that we can produce coal solely to satisfy an export market without a strong and steady component of base load requirements that are going to be used domestically. We're not here, at least I'm not, to beat up on the Alaska Power Authority. I would make one observation, though, that the industry as a whole has felt that the handling of the thermal alternatives, as presented in the various studies which have accompanied the Susitna analysis, have been strongly biased and presented a very serious detriment to the coal industry. With that, I think it would be appropriate to ask for some specific presentations. And first on our agenda will be Chuck Hawley and Jim Shaw, who will be making remarks about the Matanuska Power Project.
If I may, before you begin, I'd just like to note that Matt Sue is now online, and also Seward is now online. In addition to that, since we've started, Representative Walt Furness has joined us, Representative Jenkins, also Representative Kopanen, Representative Davis, and Representative Rieger have joined us also. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Senators and Representatives, we're going to do a two-part presentation on the Matanuska coal field. I'm going to talk a little bit about the resource, and Jim Shaw will talk more about the marketing and power plant environmental considerations. The Matanuska field was the first field that actually produced coal. It's still the second largest total production. It produced about 6.5 million tons of coal up until 1968. It's not, however, in any way comparable to the Beluga field or Healy. It just doesn't have the resource base. But the field does have some 30 or 40 years of surface mineable coal, and then it has many, many more years that would be available either for conventional underground mining or perhaps for non-conventional mining, new methods or in situ gasification could keep the field going for many, many years. And it has two significant attributes which help it out. The coal has a high heat content. It's bituminous coal, has low moisture, fairly low ash. Like all other Alaska coals, it has low sulfur. And so because of the low moisture, low ash content, under some circumstances, it should cost less per available BTU than some of the coals with lower heating content, which are more abundant. The second thing that helps the field out quite a bit, it's accessible. You can drive to it, and the end of the rail is only about 7 miles away from the coal field, and the right-of-way still exists. It formerly was accessed by the Alaska Railroad that pulled the tracks a few years ago, but it's feasible to go ahead and extend rail back in if it becomes developed. We've come quite a long ways in about the last 6 years. When I started working on the field in about 1980, conventional wisdom that there wasn't any surface mineable resource left in the field that had been mined out prior to 1968. It's just a situation where the geologists didn't see very well through the overburden. By the time you got drilling, why it turns out there is a surface mineable resource. So we've established this. We've done quite a bit of drilling. We've also done a lot of feasibility work. We've done quite a bit of environmental background. We developed a mining method which is economical and which minimizes the annual surface disturbance, even though the mine over 30 or 40 years would involve hundreds or 1,000 acres or so. During any 1 year, only about 40 acres are disturbed. It's called a direct haul back. It's a truck shovel method of mining, and it makes the reclamation a lot easier. We've been doing background studies in the area since we started. We've been working with the Plant Material Center and the Soil Conservation Service. We've experimented with both grass and willow bundles, and while I know there's every once in a while there's a little bit of static because they put it in a moose range, we haven't run into any dialogue problems with professionals in fish and game or Soil Conservation Service. It can be reclaimed for moose if that's the desired end use. And so we think that we've established the resource, we've established a feasible mining method, and we've established that we can do the mining in a good fashion. And finally, on behalf of our company, we found a good partner. Coal mining isn't something that can be done by small miners anymore. And that's, in a way, I think that's a tragedy, but it's a fact. You have to have millions of dollars worth of bonding capacity, and you have to have the dollars to do the coal mining. When we started on the project, we talked to quite a few people, coal companies, we talked to foreign producers, and we had some interest. We finally reached agreement with Rocky Mountain Energy. Rocky Mountain is the coal mining subsidiary of Union Pacific Railroad. They have direct coal mining experience. They have a very, very good environmental record. And they've been good to work with. Jim Shaw is here from Rocky Mountain Energy, and so he's going to go into some of the other aspects of the project. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chuck. Mr. Chairman, Senators, Representatives, it's a real pleasure to be here today and talk a little bit about Rocky Mountain Energy Company's involvement with the...
You have a switch on. Okay, very good.
As Chuck said, we became involved several years ago in a joint venture with him in the Matanuska Coalfield. When we originally became involved, our principal interest and expectation was in the export market. That was a time when there was great expectations concerning the growth of the Pacific Rim coal market and the U.S. ability to serve that market. Since then, our interest and involvement has expanded considerably. And what I'd like to talk about here just for a few minutes is our involvement in that in Alaska Coal, where we think we fit into that picture, and where we think it's going. Our involvement in the use of coal in Alaska began with the formation of the Matanuska Power Project, which was a joint venture activity with Rocky Mountain Energy Company, Cook Inlet Region, the Signal Energy Systems, which is now changed names a couple times as a part of the Allied Signal merger, and Holly Resource Group. There we proposed in the Matanuska Valley to put in a small steam electric generating plant, which would be financed in the private sector and operated by an Alaskan utility. We felt that the existing infrastructure, the competitive price of the coal, that the small size that fit into a picture at that time that was dominated by the Sitna project in terms of people's expectations, was something that made sense even with that general framework. One of the problems that we ran into, however, was it was not clear in many situations who was doing some of the planning activities and who, as a private sector project, we should really be talking to. There was some uncertainty from our perspective about, from the utility standpoint, which utility was responsible for which type of planning and how the various markets would be served down the road. A part of that, of course, was caused by the impacts associated with the planning of the Sitna project. But we felt that it went really beyond that, and even now today, it's still not clear to us what the private utility venture structure might be in Alaska outside of, say, a perpetual cogeneration project. We also participated both in public meetings and in written comment with the Alaska Power Authority, giving them the benefit of our advice in terms of where we thought they were looking at the process, the planning process for the future, both technically and procedurally wrong. But most important, and the thrust of our comments, and as John Sims began his statement with, is that we felt that they were the assumptions and analysis used to deal with very specific coal issues was skewed. In many cases, a single assumption or a single analysis of one small issue was not on that issue outside of the realm of which reasonable people would reach agreement. But when you put all of them together, the way I like to describe it is that if you're looking at the set of assumptions on a scale of 1 to 10, when you string a bunch of 9s in a row, you start skewing the analysis. And we felt that was a significant problem in the way that coal was being examined in that analysis. When you sit from our perspective as a mining company wishing to involve ourselves in the picture in Alaska, we find that what's going on in Alaska right now is not at all unique. The uncertainty that faces future electric generation issues is an issue that is really being faced in all 50 states. That there's considerable activity in a number of forums that are addressing that problem, not only in Alaska, but in the other 49 states as well. It's very difficult to plan in the uncertain environment with which we face today. That uncertainty is caused not only by uncertainty in issues like load growth, but fuel prices, which has a considerable uncertainty, but we're not sure in many cases what kind of demand-side influences can be used as a supply source in terms of controlling the growth in demand, as well as it's not clear the picture that certain new technologies will take. But when you put yourself in that environment, it's very difficult to make long-term, expensive decisions. And what that usually leads to is a decision that you better look to more flexible alternatives, smaller increments of power being added to the system, and projects that have a lower lead time. The disadvantage with that is that many times the decisions that you reach when you limit yourself to those alternatives don't turn out to be the cheapest alternatives in the long run. And that, of course, would appear to be what everyone's goal would really be. One advantage of making a small mistake in terms of looking to the future is that the way electricity is priced, with the marginal cost components being averaged in with the rest of the components, you can afford to make a small mistake. But to make a large mistake can overwhelm the system in terms of rolling in those average costs. One of the forms of looking at that problem that's emerged in discussions I've had with utilities all across the country is the notion of whether one wants to look to market simulation or market stimulation in the future. And the basic difference is that in a market simulation approach, we get bigger computers and better analysts and try to sort out the direction that we ought to go and regulate the direction. The alternative, the market stimulation approach, would be to take a look at mechanisms that we can put into our regulatory environment which take advantage of market forces whenever possible to help allocate the resources. And I think that's the kind of decision that everyone is going to start looking for, is the mix between those two kinds of planning methods, which then brings me to where do we go from here in terms of looking at how Alaska ought to face the coal issue. We feel that ultimately most segments of our society, not only in Alaska but throughout the United States, are going to work to a mix of market simulation and market stimulation. We're going to do a better job of planning and a better job of bringing all of the options together in an unbiased format, where we don't let the system structure itself so that there can be institutional bias in the system that's doing that market simulation, to where everybody has a seat at the table and is able to make sure that the data are correct and that the analysis are objective. At the same time, we'll try to design that system to take advantage of market forces when we can to help make sure that the allocation is as efficiently as we can do it. And we think when you look at it in that way, that there is a role for coal in Alaska's energy future. That there is a way for coal to fit into a structure which has flexible components and shorter lead times. It probably means that you might not be looking at very large coal-fired power plants, but it may very well be that the smaller increments, and even though you lose some economy to scale, that you gain that economy back in terms of the flexibility and the ability to deal with the uncertainty of the future. One way of looking at that, again in terms of a big mistake versus a little mistake, would be to take a look at where coal might fit on the margin. If you were to build a small coal-fired power plant and it turned out that, for instance, gas prices did not rise to a level that some folks think they might, and your coal, the electricity generated from coal was more expensive, if it were a small increment, and small can mean anything from 80 megawatts to 200 megawatts, conceivably even a little bit smaller, if you bring that in at the margin with a system that has maybe 10 times that much overall electricity in the system, you can afford that mistake at the margin because of its ability to be averaged in with the rest of them. If you don't do something like that to set up that kind of a diverse approach at the margin, and gas prices do rise much faster through a series of events that one doesn't have control of, your whole system costs move up and exceed that. So there is a way of looking in the future at how coal might fit into an overall energy picture that is both flexible and builds upon the shorter lead times, because obviously the smaller the project, the shorter the lead times. In terms of Rocky Mountain Energy Company's involvement, we want to be a part of that Alaska energy future, and we feel that the Matanuska field is going to provide an opportunity to do that. The Matanuska Power Project is continuing forward. We are nearly finalizing, about to finalize an agreement, conceivably this week, which will move ahead into a detailed environmental reconnaissance study of a power plant located in the Matanuska Valley in conjunction with two of Alaska's utilities. And in that study, we'll take a hard look, a very specific look, at all of the environmental problems associated with a small steam electric generating plant, coal-fired, in that area, including a very detailed modeling look at air quality emissions and its impact in that particular area, and whether there's any risk of something like impingement of a plume on the surrounding mountains. In addition to that, we are moving ahead with the export potential, which the eastern part of the basin provides us, where we think we could provide a steam coal of a quality consistent with steam coals in the international steam market today. And it won't be a big mine, but we think it'll be a step in the right direction, and one which will put us a part of Alaska's coal future.
Okay, thank you. If I may, I'm going to try to hold off on questions, Representative Copeland. There is a majority caucus at 3 o'clock, and many of the members here are going to be in attendance to that. I'm not going to go until these people have had an opportunity to address some of the questions, and I hope that as many people as are interested will, as people leave, join us at the table, whatever. I would like to note that Andrew Maru is here from Homer, Representative Maru. So if I could, Representative Copeland, I'd like to hold off on the questions until we have a chance. And I know that there are several questions that are going to come to light here, because I've written down several myself. So if you would, go ahead.
Yes, our next presentation is by Cole McFarland of Placer U.S. in relation to the Beluga project.
It's a pleasure to have an opportunity to come here to Juneau and address the combined session or combined meeting of the legislature. Coming up on a plane from Seattle this morning, flying, it's nice down that way, and it's beautiful along the range, and I've done that a lot of times, and I never get tired of the view. But I was thinking about how much in my lifetime I've been next or involved with Alaskan coal. I thought I'd just give you a little background about that and some of the things we've been doing in Alaskan coal in the past and now. The first experience was hauling ashes up the basement stairs in Anchorage in about 1937 and putting the cinders out in the driveway, which was a pretty good way to get the car up the driveway. Could have used some of that here a few weeks ago. Following that, was brought up in Ophir in the placer mining area, and subsequently took mining engineering at school. And as soon as I got out of school, I came to Alaska again with the U.S. Air Force at Elmendorf. At that time, Elmendorf was burning Evan Jones coal from the valley, hauled down by the Alaska Railroads, which was also burning Alaskan coal from the valley. And so we had two strong markets here for bituminous coal from that valley. By the time I came back up in 1959 to join the Evan Jones Coal Company mining organization, which our company purchased part of and managed, the railroad had converted away from coal, as you know. And by 1967, the Air Force and Army base in the Anchorage area also converted away from coal to natural gas. About that time, we acquired prospecting permits over in the Beluga area and subsequently converted those to leases. In 1970, we took a hard look at the marketing possibilities of Beluga coal, and natural gas, of course, was still in great supply and very low in price. There was no export market whatsoever as a possibility for that coal at that time. We've held those leases and worked on them since. Following the mid-70s energy crunch, our activity became accelerated, and we developed much larger resources than are required for any domestic or export market that we could see right at this time, in the hundreds of millions of tons. We have looked at a coal to methanol project under the auspices of the Department of Energy, and with a co-effort with the Cook Inlet region. We spent about $4 million of the government's money on that project, which when we started was emphasizing large projects as fast as could be developed. And about the time we ended the study, the government was emphasizing small projects and take as long as you can. And of course, the synfuels industry since then has gone by the wayside. The same $100 a barrel oil projections that got us and the rest of the country and ourselves excited about synfuels were the same kinds of projections that the APA consultants used in determining that Susitna would be a pretty good thing to do. So we had some sympathy with them there. Following the coal to methanol study, and we did turn out a good product. The government was very pleased with the product we turned out. It's just that the economics were out of hand. We did a 5 million ton per year export study. This was done in conjunction with Electric Power Development Corporation in Japan, a quasi-government private industry organization, much like TVA, and one of the trading companies, Nisho Iwai. This was a three-way study with EPDC doing the bulk of the test work in Japan. The results of that study technically were fine. The economics didn't fit as about that time in 1981-82. We saw the beginning of the real slide in energy prices, and of course coal became caught in that same market slump. Since that time, working jointly with EPDC and Nisho Iwai, we have done studies between 1 and 2 million tons per year. We have option on the old KLM facilities at Tionic from Tionic Native Corporation. The idea is to use part of the logging roads that come close to our proposed mine area, haul by truck to the port site. There are existing facilities, oil storage, and of course a dock there. Our plan is to extend the dock some 750 feet to where we have adequate depth of water for Panamax-sized vessels in the 60 to 70,000 ton vessels. And that's presently what we're doing, and we are doing a number of variations of engineering variations on that theme. And our latest work will be completed in May, and we'll be presenting that to our people in Japan and other countries that are interested in coal. And just very generally, Alaskan coal is a tough road to hoe in competition with South Africa, Australian, and Canadian coal that are being sold at distressed prices in the Pacific. But we are competitive on a long-term contractual basis, and we feel it's a good time, and I'm pleased to hear Jim Shaw's comments about the Matanuska Valley project. It is time for Alaska to pick up where usability has started and enlarge that export. Domestically, you've heard and you'll hear more on that from others, but I would say in the long term there are a number of interesting developments in coal. One is the fluidized bed combustion technology, which does allow for smaller increments of coal generation in an efficient and low-cost and low-emission basis. We're looking at then gasification of coal, and farther down the line, both liquefaction and gasification of the North Slope reserves that would be moved to market over existing pipeline facilities once oil and gas are exhausted. And of course, that is many, many years, and we hope many years in the future. But so coal has both a short-term and a very long-term future in Alaska, and the research work being done by the university is to be encouraged, and we're pleased to be a part of this overall process. Thank you.
Next, we have Bob Stiles from the Diamond Chuitna project.
Good afternoon. We finally got that fairly well right. I'd like to quickly cover what we've done in terms of our developments in the Beluga field and then move more into how we see as a corporation coal fitting into the long-term generation needs of the state of Alaska. Diamond Shamrock became involved in the Beluga region in August of 1981. To date, we've spent approximately $20 million in development work in that field, including marketing efforts. We are at about the stage to where our draft environmental impact statement should be out on the project within the next 30 to 45 days, and that we should have a fully permitted project this summer such that we could start construction as early as next year. Our project, like everybody else's at this table, is a market-driven project, and in the absence of having some adequate commitments in the marketplace so that the bankers have a warm feeling in the pit of their tummy and will provide the funds to finance the project, it's not likely that you're going to go forward with that construction. But we do think that, based upon our understanding of the marketplace, that our prospects for starting construction in next year are reasonably good, and starting construction the following year are extremely good. Now, we, like everyone else at the table here, have gone through the big increase in the demand for coal and then the sliding prices, and the way that the Asian market works is generally they kind of get you in a double whammy. They cut your price and cut their take. And as a result of that, you end up producing less coal for a lower price, which has some very adverse effects on your business. We think that that situation is turning around. It's turning around slowly. Declining oil prices may help that situation in some respects. But in any case, the project that we're working with is viable, we think, at production levels between 5 and 12 million tons a year. Any particular coal reserve has an optimum range of production. If you produce it below that rate, you will, over a, on a sustained basis, you'll find that you lose reserves or your costs get very high. If you produce it above that rate, you'll find that you lose reserves or your costs get very high. The optimum range on a particular block that we're working with, we believe, is in the range of 5 to 12 million tons a year, which gives us some degree of flexibility. In any case, our project is going well from a development aspect. We have gone through a similar sort of study that Mr. McFarland mentioned with EPDC in Japan. The results of that study are that on a equal basis at high exchange rates, a particular study was based on exchange rate about 250 to 1 for the yen, which is now exchange rate is about 180. The cost of power generated with Chiwetna coal delivered in Japan was about equal to the average cost of power from competing imported coals. So we are competitive when the market's in the dump. I'd like to move off that a little bit and tell you a little bit about what we've done in terms of the future power needs of Alaska and how we see coal fitting in that picture. We, at 12 million tons a year, would consume about 35 megawatts of power with a peak of about 50 megawatts. That's a fairly substantial load in a generating system that has a capacity in the range of about 1,000 megawatts. Now, that generating system would include the whole rail belt area from Fairbanks to Homer and Seward. So it's important to us, from being a large user of electricity, that the cost of that power be as cheap as possible, because it adds to the price of the product that we generate and affects our competitiveness in the international marketplace. But as a result of our recognition of what our requirements would be, we have conducted several studies, the most recent of which was a detailed engineering study of a coal-fired plant located in the Beluga region, and have come to the conclusion that within the rail belt area, that coal-based generation does make economic sense. It is competitive with gas generation when gas is trading at reasonable market levels, and it offers a viable option as opposed to an alternative for the generation of power. One of the things we did find in terms of our overall market studies as to what the demand was, that irrespective of Susitna, there would be a shortfall in generating capacity in the rail belt area sometime after 1990 or 91, and certainly before 1995. Now, that shortfall in capacity can change all over the place depending on what sort of assumptions you use as growth rates, and if you have declining oil prices, do your growth rates drop, and any number of combinations. But I think by the time you go through the unlimited number of computer models that you might, you're still going to find that you got a shortfall out there someplace. Now, generally, in today's climate, it takes on the order of 6 to 7 years to bring on coal-fired generation. If you look at where we are today in 1986, that 6 to 7 years fits fairly well within when that shortfall is expected to occur. The question is, what sort of technology do you use, and what sort of costs are you looking at in terms of power? And I think in terms of the state of Alaska, you can separate it into two big chunks. One big chunk is the rail belt area, in which case the technology that makes some sense there is either a conventional coal-fired, pulverized coal-fired power plant, or possibly some gasification technology. That's where your economics of scale begin to work at something in the range of 150 megawatt size plant. Now, You've got 1,000 megawatts of demand out there. Now, why not build 1,000 megawatt unit to satisfy all that demand? Because that's going to be the cheapest power you can generate. Well, one of the problems with that sort of a system is that like any other 1,000 megawatt system, like any other machine, is not available 100% of the time. And as was the problem with the Chugach facility, when St. Augustine went off, it was not available during part of the Beluga station, was not available during part of that time. Any machine like a coal-fired generator is only going to be able on, available to you on the order of 70 or 80% of the time. So when you look at what your total system is, it makes sense to take into consideration how big a piece you want to have all your eggs in that basket. We think that that's in the range of 150 to 200 megawatts, that you don't want to get any bigger than that in terms of the rail belt utilities. When you move into the other, or the rest of Alaska, then your economics of scale change significantly, because there you have to talk about very small units, 10, 20 megawatt units. But there is technology available that would fit within those markets. And how does that fit within an overall coal picture? Well, coal can easily be transported to coastal markets in Alaska on a year-round basis, at least in the areas where you can get in ice-free. Secondly, there are, in many places, coal reserves very close to existing villages throughout the coast of Alaska. There's a case to be made for generation of coal-based electricity in small units with local mining operations. Now, that doesn't do much for any of us at this table, but it might do a heck of a lot for those folks that are living here. I think that that kind of an approach is something that's a legitimate role of the Alaska Power Authority. I think the other thing that's clear is that the utilities within the rail belt area do not have at their disposal the expertise and the capability of moving forward individually on a coal-fired power plant. I think the investments are too large, the financing mechanisms are too complicated, and that therefore there needs to be a mechanism, a group, an organization which has that capability to assist those utilities or to pull them all together into a point to where they can legitimately evaluate two competing projects you see sitting across the table here. One of them, the Rocky Mountain Energy and Hawley Resources project, and the other one, the one that we're looking at. Now, we just love the opportunity to sit there with these folks and see who can cut the best deal. But it needs to be done by some organization that can assist the local utilities and cooperatives, and it brings to that group the financial expertise, the project management expertise, the financial backing, if you will, to where they could go forward with a project of the size that we're talking about. And size is something on the order of $350 to $500 million for a 150 megawatt station. We might find some argument at this table as to whether or not that number is too big or too small, but I think we're all reasonable people, and given 14 different consulting studies, we'd come up with the right number. But I think we've spent about $500,000 of our money looking at the details of a conventional coal-fired power plant. We've had discussions with Texaco, who has gasification technology and demonstrated scale sizes in Southern California, which may have some tremendous applications in Alaska due to some unique characteristics of Alaska. We're a winter peaking utility, and that's when those gas turbines work the best. So there are a number of technologies available out there that fit not only for the rail belt demand, but also for the coastal areas of Alaska and their particular demand. And I think all of those need to be looked at, and they need to be looked at somewhat differently. But the point is that we don't have a whole heck of a lot of time to look at them, because if we dilly-dally too much, we're going to get out there in the middle of the early 90s out there, and it's just going to get a little dark and a little cold. And we're going to solve our problem with a quick-fix solution, which is throwing another gas turbine in there. And that may be a very uneconomic long-term decision. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. I would just want to ask a few of the members of the majority. I know we have Joe to testify right now, but I was going to call the speaker and tell him that there are a few of us that will be late. Is there anyone that objects to that? Maybe 10 or 15 minutes. Okay. Go ahead.
Just by way of introduction, I'd just like to thank Bob for a very good introduction, really, to the third man on the block. He should really be looking over his shoulder at Joe.
I'd like to start off by explaining a little bit about the Coal Association. It's the coal operators and Alaska leaseholders. The first two words are us, and the last two words are everybody else. A point which I never lose an opportunity to point out to these other fellows. But we've been mining for a long time. And matter of fact, if you look at the history of Alaska, you'll see that coal use in the state goes back a long, long ways, back certainly to the turn of the century. Our company has been in operation since 43, and mining on our property has been continuous since 1922. And we think that we have contributed a great deal to the economy of the state as a whole, and particularly to the interior of Alaska. There have been some recent developments, and most of you are fairly familiar with what we're doing up there, I think. Just sketchily, we put out about 1.6 million tons a year, which isn't particularly large as mines go. About half of that is exported to Korea, and half is used locally. Having had a few years of experience now with the foreign market, a couple of comments I would like to make. It's been said before, but I really want to stress this. I can think of only two countries in the world, and I kind of look at, for purposes of this discussion, as Alaska, as being a separate country from the rest of the United States, from the economics of the coal industry. But there are only two out there that have any kind of presence in the export market that do not depend in great proportion to a local market as an operating base. And I can see why that is. Dealing now in the foreign market is extremely volatile, hard to get your finger on, very unstable. You're dealing across international borders with contract law over there that does not agree with contract law over here. If you get into a contest with them and you want to sue them, you'll wind up suing them in their courts, and you can guess what kind of chance you have there. So it seems to me that if Alaska is interested in a strong coal mining industry, that the first thing we're going to have to do is establish some kind of a very strong base of utilization here on which to build. Frankly, if we had not had our local customers to start with, there was no way we ever could have started in the export market in our situation. As a matter of fact, we maybe shouldn't be in the export market at all because of our location. Maybe that is best relegated to these folks that are right on Tidewater. Nonetheless, we find ourselves in that position. And there, we find also that there's a lot of opposition to the use of coal within the state. And I think a lot of it is, most of it is due to ignorance, or at least I like to think that. A lot of misinformation. And I think a lot of it is being perpetuated by the people that we depend on to give us what we think is the straight facts. And it's not happening. I look at a lot of the studies, and I expect to disagree with some of their assumptions. I expect to disagree with a lot of their assumptions. But what I find not only is disagreement with assumptions, but I find a lot of errors in fact being perpetuated. And I think that is a disservice. I think because of that, there is a viewpoint out there that we are not economical, and that is not true. There's a viewpoint out there that you cannot burn coal cleanly, and that is not true. There is a viewpoint out there that you cannot mine coal cleanly, environmentally sound, and that is not true. And those are all demonstrable facts. And we, in fact, can do all of those things. The one thing that we don't know and is what are the true economics, because there has been a great deal of confusion in everyone's mind on how to really evaluate and compare the various options of power generation. And the reason is they're not making apple-to-apple comparisons. They're making comparisons of a subsidized form of energy versus a non-subsidized. They're not looking at all the true economics. There has never been a single study that included what is the return from a coal economy to the state of Alaska. That whole entire facet is ignored. If you look at various other forms of generation, and I will look at, say, hydro per se, not any specific project, but the biggest cost of that, or the biggest money part of that, is the financing of the project. And the return from that is going to wind up in some large, major institution, a great deal east of here, I would assume. I think the same is true for most petroleum or gas-based generation, that a lot of that money does not stay within the state. It moves out very rapidly and winds up probably somewhere southeast of here. But I think that's not true with coal. I think with coal, there is a lot of economic return in the form of jobs, in the form of a steady base economy money coming into the transportation systems, which helps to build a base in transportation. And all that is being ignored, and I think that's wrong. Taking all that into account, I think that we can make a very strong case for the coal option. I don't, however, suggest that we should put all our generation in coal. I think that what we really need to do is put in a mix of power generation. I'm with, as most of the other speakers have said here, we don't want to put all our eggs in one basket, and that is true in several senses of the word. We don't want to build a huge coal-fired plants. We want to build one of our more modest ones. We want to build more than one eventually. We will put them online as they are needed, not all at once. As things change in the economy, and I don't know about anybody else's crystal ball, but mine gets fuzzy here in about 10 minutes. And so I would like to have some flexibility built into the planning process. You know, I can plan a 100 megawatt unit or 150 megawatt unit and say, yeah, that's going to work pretty well for a certain length of time, but I can't tell you how long it is before we need the next one. But let that one run for a few years, and then I have a few years more data, and I can, in fact, tell you when the next one needs to come online. In the meantime, we don't know what the changes are in the technology, because it is changing out there very, very rapidly. We don't know what the changes are in the economic viewpoint. I think the last couple of years, the oil economy should tell us that those things are not very predictable. And so let's take advantage of the flexibility of being able to use multiple types of generation, which probably include certainly coal, we think, obviously gas, some hydro if it's economic, maybe even windmills, and maybe the day after tomorrow somebody will invent the NERFL and we'll all go to NERFL power tomorrow. But in the meantime, we have the flexibility to make that decision when it becomes evident to us that that is the correct decision to make. I don't think I have anything else to say.
Okay, Joe, thank you. We do have questions right now.
I just want to make one comment, Joe. That crystal ball, we call it turbidity down here.
I would remind the people as they have questions to turn on their microphones so that people in the outlying areas. We do have some people from Fairbanks to testify at this time. I would like to go there. We are going to. I'm going to ask the members that are over there to come over and join us at the table, and because we have some people from that have to attend a caucus meeting, so we'll hit. Well, I do have, I believe I have Fairbanks to participate, do I not? It says to participate. Okay, first of all, I'd just like to go to Virgil Gillespie and ask Virgil if he's got any comments that he'd like to make at this time.
Thank you for the opportunity. This is Virgil Gillespie with Fairbanks District Tourism. I was here today to observe and to listen. I really don't have any comments unless there are specific questions.
Okay, Virgil, very good. I guess most of the people that are there, there are three other people there, and I guess they're there to listen also. Senator Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to thank the panel for really a very good, constructive presentation. I have one question to any or all of you, and that is, assuming that the state is interested in assisting in promoting the development of coal, the whole coal industry, both for export and consumption, power generation, whatever it may be. What, if anything, do you feel the state could and should do?
Well, I probably can jump on that a little bit. I'm rather a firm believer that maybe the state shouldn't be in the power business at all. But that is really a separate question. I think this is one of the things that has really muddied the water on this whole thing, is that people have not separated in their minds that there are really two things we have to look at here. And the number one thing we have to look at is what is economically the best way to produce power. And the second question is, should there be a state subsidy of power in Alaska? Or should the state be the one that really does the generating, or what is the state's role? And that has never been decided. That has never been separated out. And I think that is basically a decision that you, the legislature, need to make. What is the policy? of the state concerning power generation. If the decision is yes, the state wants to be in the power business and wants to sees that as a legitimate state service, so be it. Then you go to the second question and answer what is the most economical way and what is the best mechanism for the state to achieve that goal. But you have to separate it first. Now, if you say you want to do it, then certainly if you think, yeah, we better subsidize it, then there are any number of subsidy forms that could be taken, probably in capital upfront, maybe the construction of the power plants themselves, that is the legitimate way to do it. Perhaps it's just to say, okay, we're going to pay half of everybody's electrical bill. That I don't know, and that I'm not prepared to answer. But I think the main thing is that it needs to be an apples-to-apples comparison to all forms of generation, and they need to be treated even-handedly. That has not happened to date.
Okay, Joe, if I could take that just a step farther, let's just say the decision was made by the legislature that, yes, the legislature wants out of the whole power thing, and they do not want to subsidize at all. What, then, is the steps that should be taken after that, and how would it come to pass?
Well, then my recommendation would be that probably the best thing to do is to aim to get power generation into the private sector. Under the current rules of the state, with the Public Utilities Commission setting rates for anybody that generates power, basically, there are a couple of federal loopholes that you can get around that in some ways, but they are cumbersome and at best and probably not doing the job they were intended to do. But the best thing would be to get that into the private sector, and I would suggest that what we need to look at is what is the legitimate role under that scenario of the PUC, and I would think that it probably is to continue some form of control over the distribution, the retail sales, if you want to call it that, of power, because you really cannot expect there to be competition at that level. You can't run two sets of power lines to everybody's house. That is not economical. However, since we are intertied over a very large part of the population of the state, at least, that there can be legitimate free enterprise competition at the generation level, furnishing power to the bus bar. If that's the case, just tell them, okay, here it is, fellas. If Bob wants to build a plant down there, and these fellas want to build a plant, and I want to build a plant, then we're out there competing each other against each other, selling coal to these utilities at whatever we can do. And you can bet that will be the cheapest way you will ever get power in this state.
Go ahead, Senator Cogger.
Joe, but in order to accomplish that, we're in a position where we have to then get the Alaska Public Utilities Commission out of regulating the power generation part and the part where they claim, I believe it is, that now a generator can only make 12% on his margins. Well, if your debt services are up there, isn't there some basic areas there that we'd have to get into?
Well, I suppose that would be the other way to do it. Say, okay, well, we'll keep them under the PUC, but we will let them make what is a return commensurate with the risk. And I'm a little vague as to what their rules are, but I know if you look at the state, there is very little private power generation. All the generation is either some kind of government or quasi-government, i.e. cooperative-type non-profit organizations. And that tells you it's because nobody wants to get into the business because they won't make any money in it. We are looking here, don't have the numbers yet, but I think that if you look throughout the country, you'll find the states that have the most private power generation probably also have the lowest rates.
One more question.
Go ahead, Senator Cogger.
I have a bill in that's going to be heard before the Labor and Commerce on Friday, exempting utilities that have 750 hookups or less from all of the regulatory portions. And if I stuck a section on that bill as to generation of electricity at the same time, well, that might serve that purpose.
It might. I'd have to look at the specifics of it, but basically the thing is to let the free enterprise system work, which it does. The law of supply and demand is as immutable as the law of gravity if you just keep your fingers off of it and let it work. And we see that in oil right now. The oversupply has created reduced demand, and oversupply have created a very low price, and that will probably waver back here over the near future. But it works.
I just I have a question, and then I'll come back, and I know Senator Fahrenkamp has a question also. But just wondering, have you presented yourself, and I know you have, you've made presentations to the Alaska Power Authority over the years, I would assume.
That may not be a real good assumption.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, most of the work that was done by the APA was done without any input from the coal industry because basically we couldn't get a hearing. We did attend one meeting, I can't remember exactly when it was, but it was after they had already submitted their FERC application and had an answer, and they were, in fact, preparing a rebuttal to the rebuttal, if you want to call it that, that we were called in and asked some questions. We were not allowed to see any of the data that they had or any of the reports they had. I finally got my first copies of any of those documents in January of this year, and now have extensive paperwork throughout the office and find it extremely full of inaccuracies that could have been avoided had we been consulted early on.
Okay, we do have a person with the APA sitting in Anchorage. I hope he's listening. Would someone from the coal industry tell me why APA would ignore coal when they're making an assessment of the energy needs in the state? Why? I mean, it just don't make a hell of a lot of sense.
I'd like to answer that real quick. The problem that we run into in any discussions with APA is that we're all in the same room and they ask what the price of our coal is. Now, one of the reasons that's a problem is that that's a civil offense for the corporation that's involved in disclosing that information in the public arena, and it's a criminal offense for those that do it, which is time in a gray bar hotel. So that at this hearing right here, if you ask any one of us what our coal price is, if anybody gave it, I'd leave the room real quick, and I certainly wouldn't give what ours is. And that's one of the biggest problems we had with APA. I think it was a question of what are our true economics? That's something that we can't discuss in a public forum. I would support Joe in his contention that we didn't always get what we thought was a reasonable hearing with APA. I think that if I could for just a second, I'd suggest that in deference to my colleague here on the right, there's some lessons to be learned in terms of what some other folks have done in terms of generating power. Alaska is a little power consumer. Japan, which is a large power consumer, did something with their company that Mr. McFarland and I both mentioned, Electric Power Development Company. It was set up, and its original charter was to develop hydropower for Japan. It was, after a time, it became clear that the hydropower was being developed and that one of the major industries of Japan was falling on its face, which happened to be the coal industry, due primarily to the reserves. As a result, the charter of EPDC changed, and its charter then became to support the domestic coal industry, and as a result, growth in demand also became the leaders in technology in the use of coal in that part of the world. They also became the major importer of coal. There may be a lesson to be learned there in terms of the direction that APA takes. I'd suggest to you that there are no cooperatives of significant size in Alaska to take on the development of a coal-fired power plant. We certainly are not interested in building and operating a power plant. We're interested in selling coal. We're not interested in being a regulated utility. Although a guaranteed 12% rate of return is a pretty shiny return, and there are a lot of things that we might reconsider that. But that's a heck of a lot better than what you typically do in a coal business. But in any case, one of the things that I think we need to recognize is Alaska, it is relatively small potatoes in terms of power generation, and its cooperatives are small potatoes, and that a capital-intensive project like a coal-fired power plant needs some horsepower in there. And I would suggest to you that maybe APA is the most legitimate organization to carry that forward. The reason that there's no private generation of any significant degree in Alaska is exactly like Joe said. It's not economic. And it's questionable whether it's really economic for a company to take on that role as a generator and try to operate that as a business, where it may make very good sense for that to be done on a wholesale basis, not in the distribution, but on a wholesale basis, it may make very good sense for an organization like APA to do that.
Okay, go ahead. Then we have a question from Senator Fahrenkamp. Go ahead.
Cole McFarland speaking, and I would just add that it's really important if the state is involved in the structure of these mechanisms, whether it's APA or a new organization, so that you you foster competition. You have coal-to-gas competition. You have coal-to-coal competition. And these are real. There's, as you can see and have heard today, there will be real competition. These will establish some benchmark cost levels at the bus bar for other small, for instance, small hydro. That will give them a target to come in on. Can they beat that? Can they meet that? You know, let's take a look. And keep that competition going. That's what's going to make it cheaper. And structure the intertie is a good move. And perhaps other generation and transmission help. Low-cost money. And the same, I would reply to your question, Senator Fisher, and that is that there could be a red dog type of arrangement for export where some of the infrastructure might be assisted with longer-term low-interest money, where the state citizen is still going to come out as well as he would have maybe in the bond market or someplace, depending on what's going on in the bond market today. But that sort of help, and certainly help in continued agency support type effort in meeting the regulatory requirements. And they're pretty good, I would say. Most of the agencies don't have a real strong adverse problem. In some areas they do, but so far in the coal, I don't know. It's developing right now. Let's see how it works. But let's all meet the regulations, but let's get some support. Those are only two things I would comment on. Thank you.
Senator Fahrenkamp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think my question has partially been answered by the last speaker, but I was just wanting to ask if anyone here, say we were do away completely with APUC, and none of the municipalities, the groups, or anything were regulated like that, would any of you be willing or want to bid on MUS?
Well, since that's obviously up in my area, I'm probably the only one that can answer. It's a possibility. There's some real problems there because of siting and so forth. But certainly, if we felt that it was something that we could make a profit at, we certainly would. There may be other ways to correct that problem as well, however.
We're in need of finding some answers, you know, Joe, so thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Senator Fisher, this question.
I've been real interested in responses. I had long been concerned about APA's unwillingness to objectively look at coal in conjunction with the Susitna project. And coal was not just one. The other alternatives were also set up only to be knocked down, so far as I'm concerned. But one issue that has arisen time and again has been the air pollution resulting from coal. I have heard this over and over again from APA people as well as others in the Anchorage community and people interested in the Susitna development. And I heard in the initial presentation that a statement was made that I've heard before, coal can be generated, power can be generated from coal without pollution. Could, again, one or more of you explain sort of what new technology is that would allow, let's say, coal generation in the Cook Inlet Basin without Anchorage getting covered by a cloud of soot or smog?
Yeah, I'll be glad to jump on that. So will everyone else.
Yes.
If you want to take it, go ahead. But really, most of the data you see, and you see some numbers that are astronomical as to how much various pollutants there are that go out. And most of those are based on design from 20 years ago. We have a Clean Air Act that's been in there quite a while now. It's interesting that throughout the United States, since the Clean Air Act became effective. I'm not sure exactly sure of these numbers, but these are pretty close ranges. I think there has been a 27% increase in the amount of coal-fired power produced in this country, and there has been a decrease in sulfur dioxide emissions. So that indicates to me that we're doing the right thing, and you have to remember that there are still a lot of very old, particularly back east, plants that are still running and are grandfathered in or have made some concession to it but are not meeting today's standards. So it's not a question that really has much validity, because in order to operate, we have to meet those standards, or we do not get a permit to operate. So right off the bat, that's what you have to keep in your mind. The second part of that question, then, I guess, is, well, how do we do that? And basically, there are two or three ways. Number one, we use the same old technology, and then we add on things to the plant to make sure that we take all these bad things out of it. We put in scrubbers, we put in baghouses, we put in precipitators, We do any number of things to do that as an afterthought. As it turns out, Alaskan coal, because it is so low in sulfur, and that is one of the really problem areas, is sulfur dioxide emissions, we really don't have as big a problem as most other places have to start with. The particulates are not a very hard problem to solve. The nitrous oxide, which is another form of pollutant, are less with some of our coals because being lower ranked and having a fairly low burning temperature, you don't produce as many. So that is a good solution. Now, what I'm saying is that our coal is particularly good from this viewpoint. But coming on stream now and over the last 10 years and over the next 10 years, we're seeing a new generation of generation. We see new technology being developed because of these same problems that say, let's not solve the problem as an afterthought. Let's solve it as part of the process. And we see that specifically in two areas. Number one is the fluidized bed combustion, which does an excellent job. And the second, which is even newer, and I think perhaps more exciting, is the coal gasification going directly to gas turbine combustion. It has the advantage of not only being extremely clean. The biggest test plant for that I know of is in Southern California, and the figures I hear are that it only reaches about 10% of the allowable emissions for the state of California, which is one of the toughest in the country, in the world. So they are doing an excellent job there. It is not an add-on. It is part of the process. Has the added advantage of probably having lower capital costs than the other solutions. So that's how we're doing it.
Could I have one of the people expound a little bit? There's some of us here, maybe I'm the only one, but on gasification, I'm not exactly sure that I understand that whole concept.
We've been in the process of doing some studies on that and personally been involved in coal gasification since the early 70s. But basically what you do is you take coal and you combust it in a reducing atmosphere, an oxygen poor atmosphere. And what it does is it generates a low BTU gas, and it generates some heat that you can use to make steam, and you take the low BTU gas and you run it through a conventional turbine, just like the ones that we've got all over the state, and you take the steam and you run it through a steam turbine, and then you take some heat off the back end of the gas turbine and you make some more steam and you run that through the steam turbine and you get a lot of squeal out of the pit. So your thermal efficiencies are pretty good. Now there's a whole lot of different technologies for gasifying. There's Texaco, there's Lurgi. The Germans have been gasifying coal since before the Second World War. The South Africans right now not only make synthetic natural gas, they make synthetic fuels, they make synthetic feeds to chemical plants, all based upon technology that dates back to the 30s. So the technology's been there. The key has been how do you put the technologies together to make economic sense. And as Joe said, the Cool Water Project in Southern California, which is about 120 megawatt power generating station, is probably the cleanest burning plant, and maybe including many gas plants, of any plant in the United States. And back to the question of, you know, how do you meet the environmental requirements? Japan has stricter air quality requirements than the United States. When you take Alaskan coal and you try to burn it in you build a plant in Japan to burn Alaskan coal, it costs more to build that plant than it does to burn the typical imported coal. But because of the environmental characteristics and those alone, that plant ends up generating cheaper electricity, because they have to remove fewer pollutants. So there's a couple of things out there that are really going for us. Gasification is one of them. The fluidized bed is another. And the fact that we have an environmentally very clean coal in this state, you got everything going for you. All you need is some sort of decisions to get on down the road with.
Representative Moreau, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I had a couple of things I wanted to point out. In the loose leaf notebook we have here, the executive summary is actually a very well done brochure. And I just wanted to compliment whoever put this out. I double checked a couple of figures here. It shows hydro cost of putting hydro electric power into production at around $3,500 per kilowatt installed. And I did a brief calculation of Bradley Lake, which is going to cost at least $350 million for 90 megawatts, and that's about $4,000. So that's very close. Also, it shows that gas It's about $500 per kilowatt, and the recalculation on Homer Electric Association's new gas turbine generator comes out almost, which is $18 million to 35 megawatts, comes out almost exactly $500. So therefore, I place a lot of credence in what is in the rest of the book.
If I could just add a comment on Bradley Lake. The FERC license for Bradley Lake is for peaking purposes only, and to represent Bradley Lake as a 90-megawatt baseload facility is entirely false. What we're probably looking at with the restrictions of the license and in-stream flow restrictions is something below a 50% available capacity, so somewhat less than 45 megawatts on a year-round generating basis is Bradley Lake's real capacity.
Thank you. I wasn't aware of that. Something else I want to point out in the history section here, it shows that in 1786 there was an English trader, Captain Portlock, who found coal in my district, what is now Port Graham, Coal Cove, and that really stunned me because that's obviously 200 years ago when coal was first found there, and in fact the first coal mine in Alaska was at the same location in 1855, 131 years ago. I realized that coal had been around for a while in Alaska, but I didn't realize it had been around and mined apparently commercially for that long.
Gentlemen, we have a person in Anchorage, and I don't know who they're affiliated with or anything else, but they have called up and said they want to testify, so we're going to I'm going to go to Anchorage, and we have a Lee Nunn that would like to comment. So,
this is Lee Nunn in Anchorage. I'm chairman of the board of the Alaska Power Authority. I've been interested in the testimony that has been given today, and the Power Authority has been brought up in several contexts. I think it would be useful for everyone to be aware that the Power Authority is proposing to do a review of the various alternatives and studies that have been performed to date with respect to the former two-dam Susitna project. And the idea in this process is to pause in the process of trying to determine what is the best energy source in the rail belt, and to review the economic situation that we have before us, and to reassess the assumptions and the figures that we have been dealing with. And I was interested to hear some people take exception to those assumptions. It's not to say that there have not been serious contentions with those. However, I do know that the group that's provided most of the testimony today has provided a number of significant corrections and pieces of information that have been incorporated, adopted, and used in the analyses that the APA has been putting together in reviewing some of the current alternatives, and I think that's helpful and useful, and I would encourage that. As a matter of fact, I've been with the APA board now for some 2.5 years, chairman for coming up on a year and a half, and there have been no requests that I'm aware of where people have come to me and asked for information that we had at our hands, public information that we've not been able to deliver. And I would like to offer to be helpful in that regard. There are people that feel that we're working these numbers or the assumptions behind closed doors. I'd like to avoid that. I think that this opportunity that we're about to embark on to review all the alternatives and sort of upgrade our economics is a prime time to do that. So I would encourage this group to come to the APA with the things that they think are out of line. Okay. So the APA is considering holding its own public hearings with respect to these alternatives if we have a consultant who will be drawing on expert opinions to try to determine some of the power costs, the load growths, and so forth, whether they're proprietary or not through their processes that they use throughout the United States in giving testimony before calendar going with utilities taking the lead will lead to something which we in Alaska can have some confidence in. And I just wanted to make those remarks to give the people here some perception of where the EPA is going, and to offer to open it up if there's any perception that it's not an open process. Thank you very much.
Okay, Lee, I do have a comment, and this is Dick Schultz speaking. I do have a comment, but I think there are reasons for concern, as was brought out in the testimony, not only testimony today, testimony in the past that we've had before the Resources Committee when we've talked about energy needs in the state. And I think that the APA has been remiss in their duties as far as not contacting. You're saying that these people should be contacting you. As you're doing your studies and trying to figure out the energy needs for the state of Alaska, I would think that it would be well within the confines and parameters of and responsibilities of your organization to contact the people that are the potential energy producers in the state of Alaska and requesting this information from them.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to respond back to that, because I think many of the people here today have been in contact with Dick Edelman and the people that do the economic analysis for the Alaska Power Authority. We certainly can't get to everyone, but what we do is primarily go through a series of public hearings and public processes to gain this information. And if you were going for a FERC license, the need for power hearings would be a similar type of forum, and anyone can come before those groups and should, and advise the APA of their thoughts, their exceptions, and they can dump whatever they wish into the public record and get their case before the power authority. Of course, that, like the testimonies being given here, will become a part of the record of those proceedings. Now, in the absence of those people coming forward in those types of forums, we do need, and I agree with you, need to have an outreach program. And that has been performed, I would say, in the past, primarily through contractors that have worked for us. And I'm not talking about a current permanent engineering contractor, but contractor consultants that work for Baker's American, Patel, and FERC, and others to try to ascertain the proper numbers. But this is the purpose of public meetings that I just indicated. We can also go to these three primary potential coal plant developers or coal producers and discuss with them in some more detail, because they are actors. They're endeavoring to participate in the economy of Alaska, and I would think that they would have the best information. And we certainly will not omit those three, and we'll reach out and try to see what the new numbers are that they might have. And I appreciate the comment and the opportunity to respond to that. Thank you.
Okay, Lee, this is Dick Schultz again. I just want to follow up on that just a little bit. Now, I'm not talking just exclusively coal. I'm talking about all the potential energy producers in the state of Alaska. That when you start having meetings and it's in a public forum, these people should be cognizant of it. They should be contacted. The information they provide should be included in your studies, et cetera. Fish and Game, I'll give you an example of exactly what I'm talking about. Fish and Game adopts regulations, and it's supposedly through the public process. In fact, the Habitat Division has adopted regulations just recently. I have yet to talk to a person in the state of Alaska that had any input, personal input, into those regulations. And APA goes off on tangents at times, and they do so, and they make decisions, and they make policy decisions and everything else with very little input